Tech Talk on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome in to Tech Talk, RNIB Connect Radio's regular exploration into the world of technology from a blindness and partially sighted perspective. Tech Talk, of course, is your opportunity to get your technology questions asked and answered, and we'd love you to get in touch. So why not drop us a line, that email address? It's techtalk@rnib.org.uk. That's techtalk, T-E-C-H-T-A-L-K, at rnib.org.uk. Coming up on Tech Talk this time, we'll be hearing from Cobalt, where Simon takes us through some of the company's most popular products. We'll hear from UCAS, the University and Colleges Admissions Service, and the efforts that they are going to make sure that the experience for blind and partially sighted students is accessible into higher education. We'll also be talking with Victor, who support young people and families, and we will be discussing well-being, as well as taking your emails as well. So that's all coming up this time on Tech Talk. Welcome in to our co-hosts, Callum Stoneman and Tasneem Arshad. How are you both? Tasneem, what's grabbing your attention this week in the world of tech?
Well, I'm really looking forward to testing out the new feature from the Envision glasses. So to update my old glasses and just checking out Kartik's suggestions of updating and the auto feature when it takes a picture automatically. So that's something that I will be exploring this week.
Excellent. Well, we look forward to hearing that on a future show. Let us know how you get on with that. Callum Stoneman, what's new with you?
Well, you know, a couple of weeks ago, we had that fantastic demonstration of the accessible smart washing machine. And then a couple of days ago, our washing machine decided to die on us. So I've got that getting delivered today.
Excellent.
So I'll be playing with that. I decided to buy that and try out the washing machine, try out the Smart Things app. So we'll see how that goes.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much for being with us. And we look forward to hearing from you again as we settle in for another episode of Tech Talk.
Now, if you want to find somewhere that has a range of different products for blind and partially sighted people, from simple things like talking clocks and watches, right through to a talking microwave, you could go to the RNIB shop, shop.rnib.org.uk, but we're not the only ones in town, and Dave recently caught up with Simon from Cobalt to hear more about what they offer.
Cobalt is a long-established assistive technology company in the UK, a supplier of independent living aids that can improve your independence in the home. And Simon joins us now. Welcome, Simon. Good to have you with us here on Tech Talk. Just talk us through some of your popular products at Cobalt.
First of all, good morning and thank you. As you said, we've been around for a number of years, and basically a selection of sort of daily living aids, things from talking microwave, combination oven, things like talking kitchen scales, talking measuring jugs. Very recently we've just updated our single and double induction hobs, so we've now got them with us to demonstrate today. Talking bathroom scales, a selection of different mobiles that will do simple things like just speak the number when you dial the number, right through to full talking mobiles, internet, smartphones if you will, but with traditional keypads. And we've got things like talking calculators from A4 down to pocket size, a range of cheaper sort of handheld video magnifiers, and yeah, different selections of clocks, watches, colour detectors.
So these are really practical tools, actually. They're all, I think, sort of fairly standalone. Like, you don't need lots of other devices to make them work. A lot of the time, you can change the batteries yourself, which is something that's becoming less and less the case, which is something I really like. And a lot of these devices, they're really simple to use.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, if you've got a daily living aid, it has to be something that you don't have to keep using the instructions because you've not used it for a couple of months, but you then have to get the instructions out to remember how it works. It should be intuitive. obviously, the more complex the product is, maybe the more menus or certain things that you have to do. But generally speaking, things that are used every day, things that are easy to get on with, and things that are needed. I mean, we get a lot of feedback from our customers saying, do you know if this is on the market? So, you know, can you develop it? Sometimes we can, sometimes we can't, because the market is so small, the cost of development just prohibits it. But yeah, we're now on with development of a couple of new products, which hopefully will be out next year. And again, due to the pandemic, we've been delayed, and also chip shortages and electronics and all the rest of it. So hopefully, you know, things will sort of start going forward with new products, our new products. But generally speaking, yeah, I mean, we don't go into the high tech stuff. It's stuff that is just every day.
How much involvement do you have in product design then? So some of these products you've found from other parts of the world and you've brought to the UK. But then you mentioned that you are working on a couple of things that are going to be, you described them as your own products. So does that mean that you're going to have a bit more input in terms of how they're designed and how they work?
Yeah, I guess we do two sorts of products, things like watches and clocks. We can't manufacture them in this country and sell them because of the costs. But we still get involved. We write the software ourselves for all the watches. We edit all the speech and do all the speech. But we have that then manufactured in China and use some of the Chinese chip companies to make the specific chips if required. A lot of the bigger things like the microwave, the hobs, the tape measures, the bathroom scales, kitchen scales, jugs, are all developed at our head office in Reedham. We do everything from software design, electronic design. We get involved with plastic injection companies, mould makers, metal stamping tool mould makers, and we also manufacture them in the UK as well, ourselves.
And then what about support and you know, if people have got a question or they need some help, how does that work?
We're on the phones all the time, 9 to 5, Monday to Friday. Anybody who needs any help, if they've inherited a product or been given a product by somebody and they haven't got instructions, they don't know how it works, or maybe it needs looking at, give us a call.
And are your customers, do they tend to be older people who've perhaps lost their sight later in life, or is it the whole sort of spectrum?
No, our customers are the whole spectrum. You know, we've dealt from very young children that were born with no sight whatsoever, right through to people that have lost it due to illness or accidents, or just generally old age. We cover pretty much the whole spectrum.
And is it a conscious decision to focus mostly on talking products, or I mean, I know you've got a couple of magnifiers there. Do you think about sort of tactile cues? I notice a lot of your buttons are easy to discover by touch. So you're thinking about that in a kind of a broad sense, or you're really about the talking products?
No. I mean, we do look at even things like the microwave and hobs and the kitchen scales. They've all got tactile buttons, and we're very conscious that, obviously, it's okay having a button, but somebody needs to know where that button is. So if it's not tactile, they could quite easily gloss over it and not know it's there. So we've been in this industry for 30 odd years manufacturing. We're fairly conscious of making sure when we make our own products, from start to finish, they are. And if we get involved in taking on a product from somebody else, we need to know that it will work. I mean, for instance, the blind shell phone, it's not our product, but in the early days, we spent an awful lot of time with blind shell, telling them what we thought they needed to do, how they could make it better, their menu systems, and also when they had problems with they're doing 5G turn on, we went around the country with blind shell to see our customers, to see what the problems were and where they were.
What would you say to blind and partially sighted people listening to this who perhaps would like to, try out some of your products, maybe get some hands-on? Do you have a list of events, or do you demos? Have you got a returns policy? How does that work? How can people try your products before?
Yeah, we don't sort of go around demonstrating to individuals because we don't have people on the road. Mm. We do as many exhibitions as we possibly can, but obviously there comes a point in sometimes whether it's financially viable. But what we do say is if you've got a group of people together, you're having a mini exhibition and we can't attend, give us a call. Tell us a wish list if there's certain things you want. We can send you a package to show and play around with, and then we'll collect it afterwards. Again, people that buy something, if you buy it and you don't get on with it, and it has to be in a sensible time, you know, it's no good saying 3 months later, well, actually, it doesn't really fit the bill, because you know within 3 months that it doesn't. But we say to people, if you send something back within 7 to 10 days, as long as it comes back as new, as with everything that's in it, then we'll give you a complete refund.
There you go. Can't say fairer than that.
The only thing that's slightly different with that is obviously things that are hygienic, like the oven. So if we say, if you've got the oven, by all means, we'll send it to you. If you don't get on with it, please don't cook in it until you are sure that you're happy with it.
Yeah.
If you have a look at it, you send it back. Things like the oven, because we send it out by carrier, we will give a full refund less the shipping cost.
I know as a blind person myself that we have very strong views about voices. You know, some people love a voice, somebody else might not love that particular voice. Are people able to hear the voices of the products? Are those on the website? Or
yeah, if you go onto our website, every product has a speech sample. A lot of our products we do in many, many different languages. So if you're, for instance, in an Italian and you're in the UK and you're looking for an Italian kitchen scale, give us a call. We can say, yes, you can either have an English one or you can have an Italian one, a French one, a German one. So we do different languages as well. But all the, you know, all the samples, speech samples are on there on the website.
Brilliant.
And also all the instructions. So if anybody ever needs instructions, and you know it's over a weekend and we're closed or whatever, just go on the website, you can download, and it's a simple text document, so it's easy for you know, any screen readers and speech software.
How do people get in touch, Simon?
They can either give us a call. Our telephone number is 01493 700172. Alternatively, you can email us at sales@cobolt, spelled COBOLT, .co.uk, or message us through the website.
Simon from Cobolt, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Cheers.
From time to time, technology can be the problem as well as the solution. Many of us who use screen readers, for example, can become frustrated by inaccessible websites and documents and systems. And of course, when that happens, it can be very demoralizing and perhaps not bring out the best in us. Well, we are going to explore this area now and how to cope, how to manage the rage that you might feel when you just want to throw that tablet or laptop through the nearest window. Tasni Marshad, you work in health. Is this a common problem?
I would say so, definitely. Just thinking about myself, when I'm getting frustrated with maybe using an OCR app, when I'm trying to read my post, for example, I notice myself getting quite frustrated if I don't manage to complete it accurately within the first 3 to 5 goes. I mean, I would say that's probably like my limit, basically. If it's not accurate or completed within about 5 tries, then I can really notice my frustration levels rising or my irritability. And yeah, I think that's the point that, you know, you really need to just stop and pause, notice what's happening, think about what's running through your mind. And especially if you've got negative thoughts in your mind about, I can't do this, or I'm never going to be able to get the hang of this, whether that's a new piece of technology or an existing piece of technology. And the way we think about things affects how we feel. So if we're thinking, for example, I can't do this, I'm never going to get the hang of it, I won't get it right, and the thought processes are very automatic, they happen really quickly, that then impacts on how we feel. So it can increase that level of frustration, it can increase that anxiety, it can bring on some physical sensations in your body, whether that's your increased heart rate or sweating. And then basically your behavior might be to throw, you know, the device out of the window or just throw it on the floor, or become quite snappy with the people around you, which then feeds into that increased frustration and then reinforces those negative thoughts, locking you into a vicious cycle.
Yeah. Callum, can you relate to this?
Yeah, definitely. It's Android for me, just generally the Android platform, because for my job, I do a lot of testing on various different products. And for me, it's a bit like my Mac and my iPhone and my Windows laptop. I've got them sorted. I've got the way that I use them. But with Android, I'm still fairly new to it. And I don't know what it is. There's just something about TalkBack, and it could be the phone that I'm using. It could be a number of different things, but I just find the experience not to be as smooth and as efficient, and it doesn't work with my particular braille display, so there's that. And before the comments fly in, this is not me saying that Android is terrible, because it's not. It's a great platform. And if anything, that makes me want to get the hang of it more. But I just find that the more I'm using it and the more I'm trying to type with it, especially, that's, you know, particular area, the frustration just kind of causes me to think, right, I'm just going to leave this for now. You know, and I just kind of think it'd be a lot easier if, you know, somebody else could do it. But at the same time, I'm reluctant to ask for sighted help, especially in the workplace. You know, you want to be as independent as possible. But no, it is a frustration for me, and tasks that I have to do on Android take a lot longer than they should do, in my opinion. And I think part of that is that I end up kind of leaving it.
Tasneem, I want to talk about some of the coping strategies and solutions in a second. But before we do that, we see this in a number of contexts. So when you're trying to learn something new, or maybe the device isn't doing what it's supposed to do, perhaps there's a bug in the software, or maybe like Callum, you know, you're sort of trying to transition from one device to another. Is it all part and parcel of the same thing, or are there different forces at work there?
Well, I think it is part and parcel. It's about just, I think, being more aware of your thought processes at the time, in the moment, when it's happening. And that's quite hard to do if you're not kind of psychologically tuned into your own thoughts. So the first step is really to notice what that thought process is that's happening. What is it that's rising or making your anxiety or frustration or irritability rise? So, you know, a good strategy that Callum's mentioned is actually to consider, once you're in the moment and you're kind of thinking, right, this isn't happening right now for me, I'm getting really frustrated with whatever platform you're working with, and actually, you know, walking away from it, just leaving it and taking some time out, going off to doing a completely different activity that is non-tech related, and then coming back to it is often, you know, one that I find works quite effectively. So that is something that I think is a really good strategy to go off and do. And actually, when you've gone off and distracted yourself with a different activity, it allows your mind to kind of process, reflect and digest what's happening, because your mind automatically, you know, we do that all the time. And then when you come back to it, you can then either continue with what you were doing with the tech, or maybe during that time you thought, actually, this is going to be more helpful for me to go and ask somebody else about getting some sighted input if that's required.
Right. And on that, Callum said he feels self-conscious, reluctant, doesn't really want to ask for that. How do we get over that thing of not wanting to ask for sighted assistance if that's going to be the solution to the problem? Because, of course, that may be the solution to the problem. It may just be that you need to learn to use the thing, you know, but actually, if it's a completely inaccessible document and you haven't been able to get hold of an accessible copy, then you might need to ask somebody sighted to help you with that. So what would you say to Callum in those circumstances?
I think it's a really, real fine balance, and it really does come down to individual preference. And that's a typical psychology kind of answer. It's a bit of nature, a bit of nurture, you know. I think it's definitely personal preference, and it's whatever you feel comfortable with. But I personally, for somebody who does ask for a lot of sighted assistance, you know, I have an administrator at work, so it's quite normal for me to be asking for that. But I totally appreciate and understand that you wouldn't want to be asking your colleagues regularly, or, you know, can you sort this out for me, or can you sort that out for me? So I think it's really about picking and choosing exactly which bits you want to be asking for and which bits you, it's just about learning that about yourself and asking for help when it's needed.
And it might be, I suppose, that some of the remote visual interpreter services like Be My Eyes and Aira actually make it okay, because those people are there ready, willing and able to help. You know, that it's not like you're asking your colleague who has their own work to do, so you feel like you're encroaching on their time. If you were to use one of those services, or somebody whose job it is to provide that assistance, then presumably you're going to feel a bit different about that. I mean, would that work for you, Callum, using one of those services or a PA perhaps?
Yeah, I think so, because that's the amazing thing about those services, isn't it? That they are there specifically to help us out. Whereas if you're constantly, as you both said there, if you're constantly going to a colleague and they've got their own work to do and you feel like you're interrupting them, and I'm sure the way I think of it as well a lot of the time is that if they were too busy, I'd really hope that they would say, you know, because I wouldn't be offended if someone said, nah, I'm too busy at the minute. But that's what these video interpreter services are there for. They are there for us. And I think it's important to recognise as well that they're not judging you. You know, if you ring up and ask for something that's, you know, incredibly simple, but you just need help with it, whether it's because your skills aren't quite up for doing that, or if you've just had one of them days where it's just easier to get someone to do it for you, they don't care. They're not bothered about the reasons. They just want to help you out. So, you know, I do need to make more use of services like Aira and things like that. They're incredible services.
Just on the kind of the well-being stuff then, Tasneem, I think this is something that we can all relate to. I mean, I find forms can be particularly problematic. You know, sometimes you get those calendar pop-up things and the screen reader won't find them and all that stuff. So obviously taking a moment, recognizing your emotional response, stepping away, coming back, sighted assist, that's all good advice, and we'll all take that on board. Have you got any final tips before we wrap this up?
It's also about just recognizing also if you're avoiding technology and you're trying to get into it, but actually it's just something that you're, you know, as a behavioral response, if there's something, you've got a piece of kit at home that you're really wanting to get more independent with, but actually your thought about it is, it's not something I'm able to do, you know, will take me forever. And that will then just feed into those emotions of being quite anxious, and then your behaviour is to avoid that technology and never really take it out, explore it, look at it, investigate it, which then feeds into that thought process again of, you know, what's the point? I'm never going to really be able to do anything with it. So, yeah, I think it's really important, because thoughts, emotions and behaviours are all linked in together. And it's really good to become aware of that cycle, about our own thought processes and our behaviours, which includes the avoidance aspect of it as well.
Remember, even the people who appear to be brilliant at technology will from time to time experience frustrations. So you really are not alone. Tasneem Arshad, Callum Stoneman, thanks very much. Still to come on Tech Talk, we will be hearing from Victor, who support families of blind and partially sighted children and young people. And we, of course, will be catching up with your email. That's all coming up on Tech Talk.
If you have a technology question, why not ask the Tech Talk team? Email now, techtalk@rnib.org.uk, or tweet at RNIB Radio using the hashtag AskTechTalk.
You're listening to Tech Talk on RNIB Connect Radio. I'm Dave Williams. And it is that time of year when young people are thinking about higher education. The exams are done, we await the results. And one organisation that is key in that whole process is the University and College Admissions Service, UCAS. And I remember as a youngster scrolling through pages of teletext with the available courses in clearing, just trying to get into a university, any university. And of course, as a blind person, I couldn't read that information myself. I was heavily reliant on sighted friends and family members to help me with that process. Well, it's now 2022, and of course, technology has moved on. So here to help us understand a little bit more about how UCAS works and the experience for blind and partially sighted people, we're joined by Sarah Jones. Welcome, Sarah. Good to have you on Tech Talk. Let's start with you. Just tell us a bit about your role at UCAS.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for having me here on Connect Radio. So I work for UCAS, as you say. I'm a senior UX researcher in the UX team. For those that don't know what UX means, it stands for user experience. So my job is really to look at all of our digital experiences whether that be the website or a mobile app, and indeed the application form, and make sure that that's usable for anybody that wants to use it, and as user friendly as possible as well.
And how much remit have you got? You know, are you able to say, this is dreadful, guys, we need to sort it out, or maybe it's actually already pretty good and you've got quite a quiet life?
Well, I think it's fair to say there's always room for improvement, and of course the world of technology is never standing still. So there's new size screens, there's new types of devices, whether those be accessibility software tools or just mobile devices that we commonly use every day. So I think the scope is always changing, and we know it's not perfect. So, you know, hands up, there will be difficulties, but I think there's plenty of opportunity for us to both innovate and also make it more user friendly.
Now, we know that blind and partially sighted people, of course, go to university, as do many other disabled people. How aware is UCAS of the disabled student experience?
Yeah, definitely very aware. I would say that we're regularly talking about minority groups, and that might be for all kinds of reasons, not just disabilities, but, you know, mental health conditions, any kind of special needs, whether it be with regards to eventual study, as well as accessing the information in the first place and making that application. So we have a lot of conversations internally about that. And obviously we have many obligations as well to fulfill the needs of those users. So it is important to us, as important as it is to make it usable for anybody, really.
And what is the motivation? Because we sometimes, when considering accessibility, think about, you know, the incentives, the carrots, if you will, and then also we sometimes think about the sticks, perhaps the legal obligations that companies often have to make their products and services as accessible as they can be. What drives you and UCAS to improve the user experience?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think personally, I've had an interest in accessibility for quite a long time. I used to work for an assistive technology company, and it started there, I suppose. And I think when you observe people struggling, your natural instinct, hopefully, is to want to help them and to make things better. So I've really taken that forward in my career, and now I'm a user researcher, I regularly see people struggling to complete tasks, and that can be for all kinds of reasons. But, you know, making a decision to study a course and apply to university is not an easy one, regardless of the technical steps that you have to take to do that. And I think, unfortunately, I often see the expectations are quite low from users with sight impairments. So possibly their experiences around the web have led to that. But sometimes I'm listening to that screen reader talking as I'm interviewing and moderating a study, and the steps that the user's having to struggle through, I just think, wow, this could be so much better, so much clearer and easier for them. And that's really the motivation for me. You know, I can't believe sometimes people put up with the difficulties that they have. So, yeah, that's really motivating for me, is to get that user voice through to the right people.
An often repeated mantra in accessibility circles is, if you improve the experience for somebody with a disability, often you improve the experience for everyone. Is that true?
Yeah, I absolutely believe that 100%. Yeah, I think a common aspect of that is just choice of language, really, and making our jargon that, as somebody at UCAS internally, you sort of live and breathe it, don't you? When you work somewhere, you understand all the acronyms and words that are used. But, you know, simplifying that for international students, for example, is definitely going to make it easier for everybody that has to read it.
Now, the reason we're having this conversation, I sort of first became interested in your work when I heard that you had reached out directly to blind and partially sighted students. Can you just sort of tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, certainly. So there's two full-time researchers at UCAS at the moment. And my colleague Lanka actually reached out to my local blind college. So I live in Worcester. That's New College. And we asked them if there were any students who might be willing to help us. And we set up an opportunity so that I could go into the classroom and observe the students and ask them some questions really about their experiences looking for, selecting and then applying for university courses. So they were really great in setting that up for us and very pleased, I think, that we'd reached out to go and see them.
And what did you ask them? And crucially, what did you learn?
Okay, so it was, I learned a lot. The main things that I wanted to ask them were not just technically how they got on with the experience, but how emotionally that had been for them and what different challenges they have along the way. So I think, as you introduced me, a lot of people consider UCAS to be the application form, if you like. And yes, it was on paper originally, but now that's all digital, of course. But we're really trying to be much more than just an application form. And really, our services are there to support young people making those post-16 choices for their future lives. So not just applying for undergraduate degrees, but maybe they're thinking about apprenticeships, weighing up the options, maybe studying abroad or taking an internship or even applying for their first job. So we're really trying to provide a lot of information and guidance along that decision-making journey. And I think what tends to happen, or the risk, is that accessibility can become a bit of a tick box exercise or a checklist, if you like, where people are looking at the code behind a website and making sure they've ticked off all the AA requirements to make their website accessible. But what I realized face to face, and this is what I like when you meet users like this, is you get a real sense of the context of their task and the activity. And what I realized when I went to New College is that for them, the process of choosing and applying to universities is not just about navigating a website or completing an online form, but it's a really giant step into the world of further education. And really feeling like they'll be supported when they get to that destination, both in terms of the course itself and the tools that they'll have available to study and live there independently. I think, you know, that's a really big decision, and it's about getting hold of the information and understanding what their future looks like, as well as technically completing the process.
I really struggled, actually, when I went to uni. I was promised the earth by the institution in terms of, yeah, no problem, we'll get you all your learning resources in accessible formats. And when I got there, it was a real battle and a real struggle. And you mentioned the emotional impact of that. And I ended up feeling, you know, quite fed up. And I actually left in the end. Is there a role for UCAS in trying to communicate accurate information about what support students can expect when they're at university?
Yeah, I think there definitely is a part we can play in that. And it might just be that we need to highlight the appropriate contact details, for example, so that they know who to direct their questions to when they're contacting universities. Or maybe it's adding new filters in the course search engine so that you can pick out courses that might meet specific needs like that. So I think there are definitely things that we can do to assist, and we work closely with our university and college partners to, you know, give access to that information and ideally put people in the right place. So like you said, you gave up your future decision there, and I think everybody wants people to be in the right place, and if that's not with them, then that's okay, you know. So I think we can definitely help with the signposting and make that easier than it is right now.
So tell us specifically then, what happened when you went to visit those young people? Did you have them testing the form, or how did that work?
Yeah, so there were about 10 students in the room, and they were all using different devices, which is, you know, typical of the world that we work in at the moment. So a lot of them are using laptops, which might have a screen magnifier or screen reader. And there were other students with their mobile devices. There was one lady there who was just using a Braille device, and she'd only been using it for a very short time. So this is another thing that you have to consider, is that often students are learning themselves how to navigate with tools like this. And it can be very difficult for the teacher even to support that because, you know, particularly with a Braille device, there's nothing for a sighted assistant to see. So we're having to muddle through and make sense of what they're telling us. I don't read Braille, unfortunately. So that was a real challenge. But the way I started the session was to ask students what stage they were at in their decision-making process. And again, there was a big cross-section. So we had students who had applied and even been awarded and offered a place, and then newer students who were just starting to think about what they might do when they leave college. So I asked them what factors were important in that decision-making process, and what were the challenges they'd had when they were trying to look and weigh up the options.
And what were the key sort of takeaways for you from that session?
I think one of the big ones is that a lot of the time the activities are with their parents, so whether or teachers, so whether that be actually just filling in the application form for them or helping by looking at the screen and telling the students what's going on there. So we would ideally like to be in a place where they didn't need to do that. Another takeaway, I know some of the students were starting to think how hard it might be to go to university if they'd struggled even to complete the application form independently. And for me, that really drives home the need for accessibility, not just technically, but with the content and support too. So UCAS really wants to support any type of student making that choice. So it might sound a bit cheesy, but really it's an opportunity to make a difference. And that's part of the core of our own goals at UCAS.
I remember going through clearing. So this is the process. If you don't get your, you know, first or second choice university, then you kind of look at other institutions or other courses that might be available. And I remember feeling there was a real pressure in terms of time, you know, that places were going very quickly. You know, it's almost a bit like sort of buying a house, you know, somebody else would be putting an offer in before you, you know, and you had to be very agile and very responsive. And I sort of feel that maybe as a blind person trying to navigate that process, I could be at a bit of a disadvantage. Is that something you're aware of, something you're thinking of, or is that still an issue even?
Yeah, I mean, clearing's a really important time, and actually increasingly for students tends to be where they interact with UCAS the most. And to be honest with you, a lot of students really benefit and appreciate the one-to-one phone support that we offer. So I would say most students really like to phone us up and have that conversation and reassurance as well. There's plenty of choices still in clearing generally, depending on what subjects you want to study. So I think having somebody at the end of the phone who can guide you through that is valuable to a lot of our customers, regardless of whether they might have a disability or not.
I used to love trolling through the list of courses because there were subjects there that you just didn't even think, you know, people studied. Golf course studies came to mind. Sarah, what's the best way for people to feedback if somebody is using, you know, UCAS or applying or using clearing and they're having a frustrating experience? What's the what would be your advice?
Well, if you need someone's help very quickly, then do call us. There are lots of people available, especially during clearing, to take your call. But particularly, I'd be interested to hear from you. So please do get in touch. If you're interested in taking part in some user testing sessions, we're always looking for participants to work with. So if you're just considering what you might do in future or you're ready to apply to university, then come and find me. You can find me, Sarah Jones, on LinkedIn at UCAS or email ux@ucas.ac.uk. I'd love to hear from you and you're welcome to come and show me what the problems are.
At RNIB, of course, it's our business to provide information in multiple accessible formats, large print, Braille, audio. People interacting with UCAS, are we able to get information in those formats?
Yeah, absolutely. And we've had a lot of conversations recently about content formats because I think the takeaway is one size really doesn't fit all. And regardless of obvious barriers like not being able to read print, some of our users just find it easier to access information in a different way. So that might be video, for example, or podcasts. And we're definitely exploring with those different formats to try and make the information easier to consume. So hopefully there's something that is more suitable for each individual. But yeah, I mean, of course, we would definitely provide things in alternative formats to suit the user.
Well, good luck, Sarah Jones, Senior UX Designer with UCAS. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Roger Rees-Evans from South Wales has written to techtalk@rnib.org.uk and says that he enjoyed our demonstration of the MoveIt app a few weeks ago. However, he's recently experienced difficulties in looking up times from Neath to Swansea and wonders, is this an issue in settings or is MoveIt experiencing some problems? Callum Stoneman, what do you reckon?
Yeah, this is an interesting one. So I have looked into this. Of course, the problem for me is that I'm not anywhere near Wales, and I don't know the area. But I did try, changing my region and planning a route, and it didn't give me any bus information, but it did give me trains, which is different to what he's getting there. Apparently, it's recommending for him. It's just recommending Uber. So I'm gonna investigate this one. To be honest, I'm going to try and investigate this one, and hopefully we can get back to you privately, or we can cover this, in a couple of weeks, maybe.
Okay, well, keep us posted. We'd love to hear from you if you are a user of the MoveIt app and are you experiencing any difficulties or do you have a solution to that problem? And of course, we're always glad to hear from you. So if you've got a question, comment, tip, or something else to share, do drop us a line, techtalk@rnib.org.uk. Tech Talk, TECHTALK at rnib.org.uk.
Here's Luke Wakefield from Victor, who support blind and partially sighted families.
Now, as somebody who has been blind for most of my life so far, he says, touch wood, there are a number of organisations who offer specialised support for younger blind and partially sighted people. And one of those is Victor, that's VICTA. And joining us from Victor is the head of operations, Luke Wakefield. A very warm welcome to Connect Radio. Luke, just give us a little bit of an overview for those who don't know. What's Victor all about?
Yeah, of course. So Victor, we're a national charity. We support vision impaired young people from the age of 0 through to 29. Within that, we have a series of different age range activities. So we have our early years activities for 0 to 4 year olds. We then have family activities. Family days are very popular, family weekends. Then we have our age range activities. We split those up into 10 to 13, 14 to 17, and then 18 to 29. And we feel that those age ranges, those splits, cover key transitional phases in terms of schooling and then leaving school into either university or the workplace.
So all these activities are designed for blind and partially sighted children of those different age groups that you mentioned. What kinds of things do the kids get up to?
A huge variety of things. So it could be that we are doing a residential at an activity centre where we're climbing ropes and jumping into kayaks, or it could be that we're doing a baking course where we're developing sort of key independent living skills there in terms of cooking. We've also delivered a self-advocacy course for some of our teenagers earlier this year. Later this year, we are delivering a blind photography course for our 18 plus young adults. A lot of our activities give the chance for participants to earn certificated awards from it. So that could be the John Muir Award, which is a conservation environmental award, Duke of Edinburgh's Award, which I think everyone's familiar with, The Arts Award for those that are a bit more creative. We also coordinate the Crest Awards on behalf of the British Science Association, which is obviously Science Awards, and then lots of other sort of separate qualifications. So in the past, we've done whitewater canoeing, where everyone attending that became a level 2 qualified canoeist. So lots of opportunities to develop skills, obviously, as well as meeting people, but building up lots of opportunities on your CV as you go through our activities, go through those different ages, so that by the time you're reaching, like I say, those key transitional phases where you're thinking either about university or college or going into work, or you're out of work and looking to upskill yourself, there's plenty of opportunities to do so with our activities.
So it's about independent living skills, it's about raising expectations, about building confidence, and I imagine that's not just for those children as well, that sometimes parents having a blind child might not realise the potential of that child.
Absolutely, and we try and cover that in a number of different ways. So at our family weekends, we invite some of our young adults who have been with Victor for many years, that we know quite well, but have also gone on to be successful in whatever they've chosen to be, whether it's business, whether it's music, and just for them to come to the family weekends and speak directly to the parents, to talk about their life growing up with a vision impairment, sometimes talking about what they wish their parents had done for them or said to them, or how the education system perhaps either let them down, or some of the challenges or some of the successes as well that they had through their education, and the sorts of peaks and troughs and challenges that they had sort of going through university and going into employment. As part of that, we also record some of those interviews throughout the year that go onto our student portal. Our student portal is something that we developed over the last 12 months, which is a one-stop hub of information, if you like, for students and for parents to access as well, to look up further opportunities, activities. It could be around apprenticeships, it could be around interview techniques. There's so many different ways that the student portal could help a young person and a parent guide their child through sort of those key phases, whether it's going in secondary school, whether it's at that sort of late teen stage where they're perhaps filling out UCAS forms, whether they're filling out early sort of job applications. And we also have a section on the student portal for 18 plus, so for those that have been through possibly university or left school and perhaps looking to improve their own CV or their own interview technique or whatever that may be.
Such important work, especially when, you know, 3/4 of working age blind and partially sighted people are unemployed, and getting young people ready for work and developing those skills to become job ready is vital. What do you perceive are the main barriers facing blind and partially sighted people these days?
I think one of the big issues that comes up with a lot of our young adults is knowing when to disclose their vision impairment, and there isn't a right or wrong answer to that. It's obviously that you can use it as your USP. So, for example, if an employer is presented with 2 CVs, both say Duke of Edinburgh's award on, but one of those says that actually they are blind, then the employer will know that actually they've been through far more challenges to complete their Duke of Edinburgh's award. Similarly with, say, something like our blind photography course, if you put on there that you've completed a blind photography course, that should immediately pique the interest of the employer. But how does that work? All those sorts of activities where you might possibly think, actually, how does that individual go about it when their vision is impaired? And I think one of the biggest barriers is possibly being able to show the full potential of that person compared to their sighted peers, basically when they're applying for jobs.
Yeah, demonstrating that actually as blind and partially sighted people, we are great problem solvers, because that's what we have to do every single day. Yeah, and also very loyal, I think, as employees, you know. And I often say that inclusion is about diversity, and organisations are stronger when they have a diverse workforce, when they can see challenges from multiple perspectives. And that's certainly something that disabled employees bring to the table. I am also aware, having been to one of your weekends as an assistive technology exhibitor, that you also try to introduce the various tools and aids and services and products to your clients?
Yeah, you're right. So at Family Weekends, we have brought in different technology companies. We brought in some of the specialist schools to speak to parents, trying to make as much of the sector available to parents and young people that they might not be necessarily aware of. A lot of the families that come to our Family Weekends are new to us and sometimes new to the sector and not necessarily aware of what's available to their young person or to themselves as a family. So things like grants for assistive technology, obviously the activities, but also not necessarily being aware of some of the local organisations even in their own area. So we try and showcase as much of that as possible, and through not just the student portal but our parent portal, there is a whole host of lists of different local organisations that can obviously support in their local area, but also with education and a whole amount of other things, technology, early years, which is a section we're developing as well.
Let's talk about some of those grants, because often one of the issues, particularly with technology and even specialist technology when it comes to Braille equipment, sometimes the costs there can be significant. And I know that we are an IB and you guys at Victor, we've worked quite hard to try and make sure that grant funding is available for those who need it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The grant program has always been very successful, very popular, trying to cater to as many sort of different requests as possible. Sometimes it's not always possible, but certainly the big popular technology like iPads and things like that have been huge in amongst our young people. Things like the code jumpers that we've recently been offering grants for. The technology available is incredible, and where we've been able to support those with grants, the feedback's been great, and in a lot of cases, life-changing as well.
I remember the Victor weekend where I was exhibiting as an assistive technology specialist. We were asked to wait in the hall while the students went outside, and they were, you know, running up and down and doing, you know, sort of I want to say go ape, that kind of thing, you know. And all the parents stayed inside, and a expert came along and shared with parents about the sorts of information that they needed to include in the education healthcare plan. Now, I don't know if that's the sort of thing Victor still offers for parents, but I think sometimes parents just don't know what you don't know, right? And as a parent of a blind child, if you don't know any other blind people, then it's difficult to know what is possible.
Absolutely, and you're right, at the Family Weekends, traditionally that's what we have used those parent workshops to do, is to share information around EHCPs and lots of other things. But actually over the last couple of years, as the whole world has found out, we've managed to move a lot of these things online through Zoom and Teams and so on, and actually it's proved a lot more successful and reached a lot more people delivering our parent workshops online, which we can then do fairly regularly throughout the year. We then cover quite a lot of different topics, led by parents. They tell us what they'd like to find out more about. And the way we've managed to structure our parent workshops is we would have an evening with a professional in a certain area. So it could be around anxiety. It could be around self-advocacy. We've even had one recently on the teenage brain. And it's delivered by an expert in that field. And then we follow up with parents a week later as an informal sort of chat and conversation to talk about their own experiences with their own children. And also it's a great chance for parents to connect with others doing it that way as well. It's something that we would never have thought about before the pandemic, but actually with Zoom and Teams and all these different platforms, it's allowed us to deliver these parent workshops, like I say, throughout the year and reach those people that don't necessarily come to our Family Weekends and can spare, you know, an hour or so in the evening to attend our workshops. Just on the EHCPs, we plan to do two specialist EHCP workshops later in the year around October half term. They'll be online as well. One will be focused on pre-16 and one will be focused on post-16, and that'll be with our trustee who is a sister specialising in SEN education law.
Fantastic. Well, be sure to let us know maybe nearer the time about those and where people can sign up and all that stuff, because I know there is a real need for that. What's the best way to reach out to Victor?
So our website is victor.org.uk. Anything at all to do with our activities, then they can email the activities team on activities@victor, so that's victa.org.uk. Or, you know, feel free to give us a call in the office, 01908 240 831. We are happy to chat all day around about our activities and what we're doing at the charity. So, like I say, drop us an email, give us a call, visit the website and reach out to us.
Do you want to just give us that number one more time, Luke?
Absolutely, yeah. 01908 240 831.
Luke Wakefield, Head of Operations at Victor. Thank you very much. That's all we've got time for this week on Tech Talk. But if you would like to get on air with a demonstration of an accessible product or service, then please do get in touch and we can work with you to develop that idea. It's the usual email address, of course, techtalk@rnib.org.uk, T-E-C-H-T-A-L-K @rnib.org.uk. Tasni Marshad, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Some good tips there for our well-being, which we will bear in mind. Callum Stoneman, good to have you with us as always. Bye for now.
Thank you. Bye for now.
And from me, Dave Williams. Bye for now.